I'm Jody. I'm an alcoholic. I really miss y'all, but I do not miss the traffic at all. Oh, man, it's a pleasure to be back. We just got caught sideways, and must be that Auburn engineering. I don't know what it is, but anyway, I moved back to Montgomery and lucky enough to get to know a fellow in the fellowship of AA. And when I first got there, he was sitting next to him in a meeting and said, "Hey, I'm Joe." And I could tell the lights were on, and he had what he wanted. And anyway, we're becoming friends, and his nickname is Hollywood, and it's Joe S. from Montgomery, Alabama. So,
that's a very warm welcome. Thank y'all very much. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Joe. Man, I feel at home now. I was a little late getting here, and Jody whisked me in. I got here about 2 minutes ago. So anyhow, I'm a little nervous, but I feel at home when I hear the steps read and see the faces of people who I got. I can look at you and tell we got a lot in common. Let's find out how many hardcore partiers there are from Atlanta. Anybody in here ever heard of a bar called the Crystal Palace? Man, I'm at home. My uncle is Sid. My uncle Sid, he owned that bar. I'm glad y'all are here. Now let me ask you this, how many of y'all are Al-Anons? Raise your hand. Al-Anons? Some Al-Anon? Okay, well that's good. I wanted to ask that because I really don't feel right sharing my story. My sobriety date is July the 25th, 19... My wife always laughs because I say 1900. My sobriety date is July the 25th, 1983. And by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober one day at a time for 25 years. I'm so grateful for this. I'm so grateful for this fellowship. Man, if it wasn't for AA, I certainly would not be here. But I gotta say this about Al-Anon, and the reason I ask about that was my mom got an Al-Anon, and for those, if you're trying to figure out, I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 25 years old. And my mom started going to Al-Anon about 2 years before I got sober. And when my mom started to go into Al-Anon, the dynamics of my family changed. And man, I tell you what, I was one of those people who would drink and do dope. I'm going to talk about dope here because Jody told me I could. Don't let me offend any of you hardcore Alcoholics Anonymous people. I swear before God I qualify for AA, and I think you'll be able to know that when I get a little further into my story. But I was one of those people who, when I was drinking and doing dope, I would tell people that I wasn't hurting nobody but me, and you need to stay out of my business because it ain't got nothing to do with you. But the truth is this, my mom, at night when she would lay down, she would lay her clothes out piece by piece as she would take them off at night to go to sleep. Because she knew that her baby might call at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, drunk out of his mind, saying, "Mama, come get me." And she would want to be able to get dressed quickly to get there. And man, I'm so glad and grateful for Al-Anon, and I just got to mention that because Al-Anon saved my mom's life. I know you probably can't tell that I would do dope just looking at me. But I can remember sitting in a dope house with a friend of mine, and he was looking out the window of the, like we would do sometimes. And I said, "What are you looking at, Bruce?" And he said, "Man, I'm about to kill this old woman out here." And he had a gun. And I went over to another window and I peeked out and I said, "Don't shoot her, that's my mama." God bless her, man. My mom was out there writing down the tag numbers of the cars that were in front of her. Wasn't affecting nobody but me, though. I'm going to start this talk in 1977. The bar is Country USA in Montgomery, Alabama. It was a huge country bar. It was about the size of the Palace. It was a big bar, had big, you know, everybody get in there and get loaded. And it was a country, it was a goat roper bar is what I called it back then. And I was what I called a drugstore cowboy. I'd wear cowboy boots and a cowboy hat, and I would eat Quaaludes and drink whiskey. You know what? If you stay sober long enough in Alcoholics Anonymous, your story will begin to date itself. I got a friend that's been sober for 35 years, and he still says, "They got me on one of them DWIs." I used to laugh at him because it ain't DWIs no more, it's DUIs. But now I talk about Quaaludes, everybody looks at one another funny. Because they don't know what them are, but anyway. Anyway, Jerry Lee Lewis was playing. Jerry Lee Lewis is playing, and I'm loaded out of my mind, man. I'm shooting double shooters of Jack Daniels whiskey, and I'm chasing them with Quaaludes. I'm about 18 years old. My family's in the automobile business. I'm a car salesman. I know you can probably look at me and tell that too. I really am. That's the truth. Anyhow. But I would be in this bar, and I was new to the car business then. I wasn't 18 years old. I just started selling cars. This is when I learned you don't give out your business card. Because what I would do is I would be getting loaded, and I would hand everybody a business card. "Come see me. You need to buy a car from me. I'm Joe Smith. Hey, here's my business card, man. Call me anytime," and early in the evening. Well, then all of a sudden I get, and I don't know, man, about your alcoholism, but this is the way mine is. I get excited when I drink, man. I get excited. God, I still get excited, but man, when I drink and get excited, it's ugly. So I got excited, you know, and I picked me out a little cutie pie. And I picked her up and throwed her over my shoulder. I got a cowboy hat on, and I'm walking around the bar doing shooters. And she's beating on my back saying, "Let me down, let me down." And I'm excited. I'm loaded out of my mind. And I don't know about y'all, but, man, I had this bad thing. I would go invisible. I don't know. Anybody? You go invisible too? Yeah. I would go invisible, but I would come in and out of being invisible. You couldn't see me sometimes. But then sometimes you could see me, and I never knew when you could see me and when you couldn't see me. Does that make sense? I mean, I might walk up to your girlfriend and look down her shirt, you know, because you couldn't see me, of course, you know, because I would be invisible. That's the way my drinking was, you know. Anyhow, I picked this girl up, and as soon as I sat her down, man, I knew it was going to be a problem because she was excited, too. She drank like I did, yeah. And she said, "Show me what you got." Well, I can't be told something like that and not put up. You know what I'm talking about. So I pull my pants down. I ain't got that much to be proud of, but I'm excited. But I'm excited, so I'll whip it right out, you know. I was not invisible. Not invisible. I thought I was invisible. Now, I promise you, man. I thought only she could see me, okay? The next thing I know, I'm skipping across the parking lot in front of this honky-tonk. Because the way they would eject me is they would always grab me by the belt and the nape of my neck, and they would open the door with me, and that's how they tossed me out of bars. So anyway, I skipped across the parking lot, and when I got up, I couldn't remember anything. I did not know why I was thrown out. I knew I had done something. I don't know whether you can identify with that, but I'm dead serious. I knew I did something, but I did not know what it was. Make a long story short, somebody whoops up, picks me up in their car that I know. She worked for my family business, and she whisks me away right as the police are pulling in, I'm sure to get me. Now everything's cool, and I don't know about y'all, man, but this is the way my drinking was. And I try to remember this, and these speaker meetings make me have the opportunity to relive it so I don't forget it. Because I got a disease that'll make me forget. But I would wake up in the morning after a drunk like that, and I would snatch the curtains open on my room to see whether my car was in the driveway or not, because I couldn't remember how I got home. And then if I could make it to work, I would be so petrified that I would stand by a water cooler trying to drown myself in water, just sucking the bottom out of the water cooler. Did any of y'all identify with that? I mean, I could not get it, and I would instantly be drunk again. And when you're in the car business with the kind of old car men that I worked with, they're all alcoholics, so they know how to punch your buttons, and they're walking up to you saying, "Don't step on that dog." you're jumpy all the time, and they know how to do it. They know how to do it, you know. They just know how to, it's like being hit with a cattle prod, you know. And they're doing it to you on all kinds of levels all the time. And all of a sudden, man, there's people pulling in the car lot. And my cousin's out there talking to him. It's a family business. And he comes in and he says, "Man, what did you do last night?" And I said, "What do you mean? What did I do?" Man, I'm going to tell you something about my drinking. The worst thing in the world is having to ask somebody what you did. Because you really don't want to know what you did, okay? You don't even want to know. But you're petrified not to know. You got to know. And man, I don't know about, see y'all, those of you who are just now coming in, man, y'all got caller ID. You know who's on the other end of the phone. That's like sissy drinking there, man. When you wake up out of a blackout and jump 3 feet out of your bed and the phone's ringing and you don't know who's on the other end, that's the most petrifying thing in the world, man. And man, I want y'all to know this. I was doing this from the time I was 15, 16 years old. But anyhow, I had to ask him, "What did I do?" He said, "Man, all these people were at Country USA last night, and they got your business card and said you pulled your pants down in front of all them people." And I said, "Are they going to buy cars?" And he said, "Hell no, they came to see the idiot." That's my drinking. We had a little neighborhood honky-tonk that I lived in from the time I was a kid, and I wasn't even drinking age. Drinking age in Alabama then was 21, and I was living in these honky, I'm talking about straight honky-tonks. Shucking oysters and shooting pool and shooting one another honky-tonks. And I go in there drunk, and I'm with a friend, and I'm eating pills, and I'm loaded, and I'm just, I'm screwed up as a soup sandwich. And I'm in this honky-tonk, and all of a sudden, I don't know whether you've ever got like this, but I got this overwhelming desire to leave. You know, if I got just totally loaded, sometimes I would have to go home, and when I would get that urge to go home, I would fight hell to get there, because it was over. The party was over. It didn't matter. It's time for me to crash. I'm out of here, and I would be wall-eyed drunk in a blackout, but I would want to go home. So I'm with this guy named Ronnie, and I've decided I'm going home. And I'm hammering on Ronnie, and I said, "Man, look, please take me home." And it's about 10 o'clock, and Ronnie said, "We ain't going home." And I said, "Man, please take me home." And he said, "No, we're going to have another beer." So I drank another beer, and I'm nursing a resentment. I'm pissed. I'm ready to go home now. You know, my party's over with. But Ronnie ain't going. So we sit there and we drink one beer after another, and we are arguing. I'm saying, "Man, please take me home. I done had enough." This goes on until we close this bar up at 2 o'clock in the morning. We're the last ones to leave, and when we walk outside, I realize that we're in my car. I am pissed. So I walk over there and unlock my driver's door and slip into the driver's seat and shut the door. And Ronnie walks over to the passenger side to get in. And I drive off and leave him standing there. That's my alcoholism. You know what, man? I could share with y'all drunk story after drunk story, and I know we all got war stories, but I want to really speed this thing up and get to the gravy. It sounds from your laughter that you can identify with some of the things that I've shared, and they're wonderful to be able to laugh about today as we look back on them. Those of you who are new here, you are why I'm here. I'm here wanting to share this story with you, but I really want you to know Alcoholics Anonymous is this magnificent thing. And it knows that the only way to reach an alcoholic is through attraction rather than promotion. And man, I really want you newcomers to know this. I am not here to sell you on AA. It wouldn't work if I tried to. And I know this about my alcoholism. Until I had a moment of clarity and decided that I was really, really miserable and I was not wanting to live like that no more, then I could not get sober. And if you know in your heart that you ain't done with the way you've been living, man, my hat's off to you. And I pray to God that you don't never run out of alcohol and you don't never run out of dope, because I know how miserable that is. But if you meditate upon your life, maybe you're in treatment, you got a moment to just sit back and meditate upon your life. If you're not happy with the way your life is, then I want you to know this. There is a life that is infinitely better, and I have it, and I have it, and I'm so grateful for it. Now, I want to just share a few thoughts that are important to me about what helped me get to that place where I could really understand what was wrong with me. And I'll do it quickly. I had a friend that was robbing drug warehouses in Jackson, Mississippi for Schedule II narcotics. And from 1970 1907 to about 1979, he would go in drug warehouses in Jackson, Mississippi, and turn the burglar alarm off, unlock the door, go in. We would go, me and my sister and my brother-in-law would go through a physician's desk reference. And we would say, this is what, he was a thief, he was not a drug addict. And we would say, this is what we want you to steal. We want you to steal Demerol, Dilaudid, Morphine, Nimitol, 2-and-off, 2-and-off, Percodan, Percocets. We want anything with an all on the end of it. We want Belladonna opium suppositories. We want whole grain and half grain, shake them up, morphine. So for those years, I did free dope, okay? In addition to the drinking. And I think I've qualified myself for Alcoholics Anonymous by the stories I've shared. And I could share jillions, okay, that would have you laughing because it made me laugh. I mean, I was a straight idiot, okay? But as a result of all of this drinking and doping, when I was 20 years old, I checked into a psychiatric unit, okay? And here's what happened. I woke up in a psychiatric unit. I had been in a blackout. I didn't remember checking myself in. And I looked in the bed next to me. There was a bed over there, two beds in a room. And I saw this person and I thought, oh my God, where am I? I could tell it was an institutional bed. I thought, where the hell is it? So I threw my cowboy hat on my head and I pulled on a pair of blue jeans and I run down the hall to the nurse's station. I didn't know where I was. I said, where am I? They said, you're at the 4 South Psychiatric Unit at Jackson's Hospital. I said, how did I get here? They said, last night you rode in here on a guitar. I said, really? And I said, yeah. So anyhow. So anyway, you know, there was all these crazy people in the psych unit of God. And I'm a lot of things, but crazy I'm not. I know what I'm doing. But anyhow, they admitted this other guy about a week after I was there. He was 5 years older than me. Now, I was 22 and spent my 21st birthday in this psych unit. And this guy that they admitted was 5 years older than me. He had drank in the same bars that I did. We had mutual people that we knew, okay? Now, what I want you to know about Alcoholics Anonymous is this. There is a bond that happens between drunks that don't happen between nobody else. And me and this cat, man, we just bonded. It was like we were kindred spirits, really. And we both felt kind of the same things, and we just immediately connected. So we was laughing, and we was best friends. I was in a group therapy session with him one day, and this psychotherapist looked at him and asked him, how do you feel? And man, I'll never forget this. That guy put his head in his hands and his elbows on his knees, and he really thought about that question. He meditated upon that question. He really thought about it. And when he got done and he knew how he felt, he looked at her and he said, lady, I'll tell you how I feel. I ain't satisfied. I ain't satisfied drunk. I ain't satisfied sober. I ain't satisfied. And when he said that, it was like he had pulled the words right out of my heart. I thought, my God, that is exactly how I feel. I did not understand how important that really was. But let me give it to you a different way. And if you've been studying the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll remember it like this. Men and women drink essentially because they enjoy the effects produced by alcohol. While they admit that it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. Their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are irritable, restless, and discontented until they can again experience that sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks that they see others take with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to do it again. And this is repeated over and over, and unless that person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of their recovery. See, that's why what that guy shared was so important to me, because it let me, I did not know it when he shared it, okay? This is what I learned in that psych unit, okay? I learned that I can't drink and I can't do dope because I had cirrhosis of the liver. They did a liver biopsy on me, 20 years old, from eating Quaaludes and chasing them with whiskey. I had cirrhosis of the liver and hepatitis from sharpening syringes on matchbook covers and running them up my arm after 50 other junkies done wore the points down. Okay? So I knew I couldn't drink and I knew I couldn't do dope. So this is what I learned in that psych unit on my own thinking, okay? I knew that my problem was that I was in desperate need of marijuana. I'm dead serious. So yes, sir, buddy, me too. Yeah, hell yeah. So I left that site again and I bought me an ounce of Sensimillion. And I went through an ounce of Sensimillion once a week for the next 4 years. And here's how my life was. If I woke up in the morning and I knew I had a bag of weed, I was going to have a good day. If I woke up in the morning and I didn't have no weed, I was a miserable son of a bitch and you don't want to be around me. And then we can't just quit drinking. So what we would do is we would go to Pensacola on vacation to drink because nobody down there knew we was an alcoholic, right? So we would go down to a little bar called the Tiki. How many of y'all been to the Tiki? I figured some of you been there, yeah. So I run down to the Tiki and I'd get drunk for, you know, 3 or 4 days of my vacation, then I'd shake my brains off out and get back on the weed, and then I'd use a lot of Visine, come back, and everything would be fine. Anyhow, y'all know the deal. It's switching seats on the Titanic. Don't matter what you do. It don't matter. We switch from beer to wine, agreeing to resign if ever drunk, taking a trip, not taking a trip. It's all the same thing. They didn't talk about the weed and the Demerol and a lot of more things. It's all the same thing. But anyhow, I went into a treatment program on July the 24th, 1983. I got up that morning and rolled me a big old joint of Red Bug Colombian. I hadn't seen no weed like this in 10 years. I paid $125 for an ounce of it. It was the best weed I'd seen in 10 years. That's no joke. It was that kind you'd take a half a hit and cough your brains out. And when I rolled that joint up, I told my mama, I said, "Look, mama, I got to get help. My sister done been through all this." I said, "I got to get help." So I went to a treatment program. But I went and smoked this joint. I had a 44 Magnum Model 29 Smith & Wesson nickel-plated pistol. And I was driving, this was an 83. I had an 81 Corvette with about 17,000 miles on it. It was a super nice car. And I'm sitting in that car wanting to blow my brains out so bad I could taste it. And the reason is, I was 25 years old and everybody I knew lived by who's got it, where is it, and how much? Who's got it, where is it, and how much? Who's got it, where is it, and how much? My whole life was centered around alcohol, honky-tonks, dope houses. It was getting paid on Friday and blowing all my money and living running tabs and bars and dope houses till the next Friday. That's how I live my life. So here's why I'm wanting to blow my brains out. I'm wanting to blow my brains out because I cannot see life without a buzz. It don't even make no sense to me. It's crazy. I can't even think like that. Anyhow, I went to this treatment program. I'm going to make a long story short. I go to the treatment program. I go through steps 1 through 5 in the treatment program. I did my first step before I ever got there, okay? I done tried every angle. I knew that I was doing. I couldn't. I was powerless. I done figured every angle. I done tried every way to fix it, okay? If I'd have had another angle, I'd have done it. If I hadn't have tried the marijuana maintenance program, I would have left there and smoked weed, okay? I'd done been there, done that. I knew damn well I did not have no answer. I could not do it. So I went through them first 5 steps while I was in treatment. And I got out of treatment. I did the step 6 and 7. Then I got out of treatment. I had my list. I tried to make amends as best I could. And there's some, man, there's some of the things that I did in my drinking and my drugging that still leave a hole in my heart. So I want you to know, if you still have a hole in your heart after making some of your amends and coming to terms with the fact that some of those people are dead and some of them you won't never even get the opportunity to make amends to, but you are willing if you would see them, then just understand this, having a little bit of a hole in your heart is part of recovery for me. My recovery didn't get perfect when I got sober. You know, I see these people that got sober and all of a sudden, man, they don't drink and drug no more. And they was a bad person up until now. That ain't been my experience. I've made some bigger mistakes sober than some of the ones I did drinking. But they have been life lessons and I've learned from them. Here's some of the first ones that I had. I got out of this treatment program and I moved in with a beautiful brunette that I was in treatment with. She was a classical pianist. She had a master's in music and she was a school teacher. She had a wonderful townhouse and I was living with my parents, so she was perfect. So I moved into her house and I was listening. Now, this is fresh out of treatment, first day out of treatment. I had long hair back then. It's probably hard to imagine. But I was sitting at her apartment, and I was listening to Janis Joplin, Ball and Chain, Wide Open. And I was looking at the hair. They had kept trying to get me to cut my hair while I was in treatment. Cut your hair. If you don't cut your hair, you won't be sober. You got to cut your hair. They wanted my hair. It was like this thing for them. You know what I'm saying? It really was. They just wanted to get it. You know what I'm talking about? Therefore, I was not going to let them have it. Okay? But I'm looking at this hair on my shoulders, listening to Janis Joplin, Ball and Chain, out of treatment a couple of days, and I'm thinking, you know what? You ain't gonna stay sober if you stay like this. And I knew I wouldn't. I knew I wouldn't. There's no doubt in my mind, if I'd have stayed like that, I would have got high. So I never did use barbers. Okay? I always use beauticians. Okay. So I called my beautician and I said, listen, man, I got to cut off my hair. She said, I'll be right there. So she came over, and all I had for a role model was a guy named Mike, who was a counselor at the treatment program that I was in. And Mike had short hair, and he wore Izod shirts and breeches from the locker room that had little cuffs on the bottom of them. So I had her cut my hair as close to Mike's as I could get. And I went to the locker room. And I bought me some Izod shirts and some cuffed breeches. And I went to my aftercare at the treatment program that I went to, and everybody applauded. I was sick, and all of a sudden I was sick in an Izod shirt, you know. Now, you know what? To a lot of those people, they probably thought that I had undergone an entire psychic change. But I really want you to know this. I had not. I had not. But let me tell you what I had done. I had made enough changes to sever me from the life I had been living. And I know for a fact, had I not made some things different, I would have gone back. I would have gone back. You know, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we should look quickly to see where religious people are correct, and we should make use of what they can give us. Please don't crucify me. But in that book, in the Bible, it says this. It says, when the unclean spirit has gone out of a man, he passes through waterless places seeking rest, but finds none. Then he says, I will return to the house from which I came, and he will find it empty, swept, and put in order. And then he will bring with him seven other spirits more evil than himself, and they will enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man will become worse than the first. I've never relapsed, and that's what that scripture is about. I've never relapsed, but I've seen so many people relapse. And here's what I know about relapse. I know that early in my recovery, I passed through waterless places seeking rest, and I found none. There were times that I felt so disconnected from this world that I did not think I could make it. But let me tell you what God did for me. God would put another drunk at a meeting that would say something that would buy me 24 more hours. Now, you know what? You might think that you don't need none of this. I don't know. You make your own decision. I told you, I'm rolling with you. You're my number one horse if you never win a race, man. If you got to get back out there and get with it, I say more power to you. Be careful. Let me know how it works for you. But I'm real grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous has been there for me because, man, it has put the right person saying the right thing at the right moment for me in my path so many times I can't even tell you. You know what? I'd love to sit here and tell you a few more funny drunk stories because I've got a bunch of them. And maybe we'll go to dinner after the meeting. All of y'all can come. Because I can tell by the way you're listening to me that I love you very much because I can look in your eyes and tell you got the same deal I got going. And we need each other. So I'm going to close with this story. I was 17 years sober. I was with wife number 3. I'm currently with number 5. She's got it tattooed right here. She's number 5, man. And she's cool as ice. Let me tell you something, man. She's a baby doll and cool as ice. And I wish I could have brought her with me tonight, but I don't want her hearing my talk. She inhibits me from sharing the truth because I will measure my words. I don't go listen to her speak either. She's been sober by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 years. And she's a miracle among miracles. She's cool. But anyhow, I was married to number three at the time. And I was in Pensacola, Florida. Any of y'all been to Fort Pickens? Raise your hands. Fort Pickens. I love Fort Pickens. It's a cool little place down there, a little peninsula, you know. And me and my ex-wife, and we had another girl with us. I haven't always followed spiritual principles perfect. But we were down at Fort Pickens. And about 11 o'clock that night, this orange microbus comes whipping up into the, this is a campground, and it comes whipping up in the campground, and this guy gets out of it just hammered. And he comes, it's 11 o'clock at night. Now we're tired, none of us drank. We're ready to go to bed. And this guy comes over hammered and he wants to be my best friend. I said, let me tell you what you need to do. You need to just spin around and go right back over there and get in your van. We don't want none of that. And he looked like I had killed him, but he staggered off. And I knew drunk, so I knew he wouldn't remember it. So I wasn't worried about hurting his feelings. I didn't want him over there. So the next morning, I'm eating me a biscuit at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he jumps up wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, and he comes running back over to my campground. And I can't help it. I said, man, listen. Oh, wait, stop right there. Whoop! Last night, me and these two girls are sitting here, and you come over here and pull down your pants and wag your business. I love y'all. Wagged your business in front of all them. You just need to go on. And he looked like I had killed him. He said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And he started running for his van. I started laughing. I said, I'm just kidding. Come here, man. I'm just playing with you. You didn't. You were fine. You were really good, man. We had a lot of fun last night. So he looks at me and he said, I'm 17 years sober. He looks at me and says, you want to go fishing? I'm thinking, I would rather take an ass whooping than go fishing with you. This is what AA taught me. I said, man, I would love to go fishing with you. So he grabs his 300-pound cooler and his big old fishing rod, and he starts dragging it to the beach, and it's leaving a trench behind us. I carry one little old fold-out chair down there to the beach. Now, I've been going to the beach all my life. Okay, and maybe I hadn't been paying attention, okay? But I ain't never seen nobody walk out in the surf and fish, okay? I ain't saying they wasn't doing it. I just never paid no attention to it. But I get out there and I set my little chair down, and the guy walks out in the ocean with this big old saltwater rod, and he's got cigar fish, and he's throwing them in these. And the guy starts catching fish. I'm blown away. I'm thinking, my God, I'm impressed, you know. Shit, look at you, boy, go. And I really was. I was blown away. But the guy's drinking a Budweiser, and he looks at me, and he says, man, get you a beer. Get you a beer. I said, man, I appreciate it. I'm good. And he's fishing, and we're talking, and he's fishing, man. And the more he drinks, the more he's hammering on me to have a beer with him, man. He's got to have me. This is not an option for me not to have a beer. And the reason is, he knows he's about to get way out there, and I'm not. So he needs me with him. timing is everything, man. So I listened to him all the time. Oh, man, have a beer. And I said, no, thank you. No, thank you. I did it as long as I could, man. And finally, he's got that real desperate look. And he says, man, please have a beer with me. And I looked at him and said, let me tell you why I ain't going to have a beer with you. I said, I ain't going to have a beer with you because I've been sober and Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time for 17 years. And the reason that I'm grateful that I'm not having a beer with you is because in 17 years of sobriety, the thing that's most important to me than anything else in my life is that I remember what I did last night. And he looked like I had hit him in the face with a ball fist. And I did not want to hurt him, okay? But the guy goes to casting that rod and thinking. And things got real quiet. And then he looks over at me and he said, you know what? Everybody calls me Hollywood. He said, Hollywood, let me tell you something, man. He said, I was sober in AA for 2 years once. And I looked at him and I said this, and I mean this from my tippy toes. I don't give a damn if you've been here 2 days. I don't care if you got high on your way over here. I don't care. If you got high on your way over here, you continue to do that, because if you keep coming, you'll let it go. You'll let it go. Just don't disturb nobody and don't take nobody else with you. But I looked at that guy and I said, man, listen to this right here. We need you. We in AA need you. And I said, there's going to be a guy that's going to walk into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And there's not going to be but one soul in the whole world that can help that guy. And that soul that can help him is you. I sure do hope you're there. And I hugged him, told him how much I enjoyed watching him fishing, and I left. I left him there with his thoughts. You know what, I got this car dealership, man, and I just love it. It's like a family business. Years ago, everybody drank and gambled in there, you know. My grandfather started in 1942. We're the oldest active independent used car dealership in the state of Alabama. But they would drink and gamble in there. I know that's shocking. But as a result of me getting sober and things changing, my grandfather since left. That's one of the holes in the heart that I have, is I was around him sober for a long time, but I sure could have been better while he was here. Even though I had recovery, I could have been a hell of a lot better than I was. But I'm sitting down there in my car lot, and this friend of mine, he comes in and he says, Hollywood, how you been, buddy? I said, man, everything's good. He said, you know, I'm in that long-term treatment program down there in Jackson, Mississippi, and I come home for the weekend. I was in a group down there, and I told him I was going home for the weekend, and this guy looked at me and said, where are you from? He said, I'm from Montgomery, Alabama. He said, do you know Hollywood? He said, man, yeah, I know Hollywood. He was my addictions counselor when I was in treatment. And he's my brother's sponsor. He said, hell yes, I know Hollywood. He said, you tell him that guy from Fort Pickens got 6 months sober. You know what, that's the kind of high that I get in AA that I could not never get nowhere else. I could not never get this nowhere else. And that's what it's all about. That guy, Mike, that was the counselor, that was my counselor, he had the most insight into alcoholics that I've ever seen in my life. I mean, this guy was brilliant. I got out of treatment. I'm gonna wrap it up. I know what time it is. And I hate to be cap over, and I'm gonna get done right quick. But I was, he had this ability to be able to see the big picture on alcoholism in ways that I thought, man, he's brilliant. Well, I went to work for him. I was 2 years sober and got a job with him, and I was an addictions counselor, had a wonderful career working with Mike. I was sober probably 20 years and the phone rang. And I never could understand why Mike understood alcoholism like he did until the day I answered the telephone, and it was Mike's wife, and he said, "Joe, Mike's having problems with alcoholism, and he told me that you was the only person that he wanted me to call." You know what? I sponsor Mike. And I share this with y'all. Just keep coming back one day at a time, no matter what you're thinking. Because the miracles that can happen in your life are uncountable. And y'all have been a great audience. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Joe. That was really special. I really appreciate that. Laughter's good medicine. I've asked Don to give out the chips.